Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What will it take to harness the power of the sun? And how do the political will and the financial resources necessary compare with advancements in the technology that might make it happen? In the September issue of National Geographic magazine, writer George Johnson presents us with a broad-ranging portrait of solar technology in the early 21st century, how it's being applied, and where it is making the biggest difference in the way human beings power their lives. The article is called Plugging into the Sun. George, welcome to Think.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
There are essentially two ways that we have right now of capturing solar energy. The first is with mirrors and parabolic troughs. Can you talk about how those work?
Yes, right. Two ways that we capture it to make electricity, because there's also passive solar, you know, where you can build a house to use the sun to heat water for your hot water heating, or that's an active solar application, or you can use it just to heat your house indirectly by having windows facing the south. But what particularly interested me was how to generate electricity with solar energy. And as you say, there's two ways. And one is to use it to heat water to make steam to drive a turbine, which is the way we usually make electricity with coal or nuclear, by heating water. Or you can convert sunlight directly into electricity using photoelectric cells.
And how do those cells work?
Yeah, they're often called photovoltaic cells, or PV. And It's a phenomenon that was discovered by Albert Einstein early in the 20th century. And the photons hit certain semiconducting materials. They essentially knock electrons off some of the atoms, and then the electrons hooked to a wire will cause a flow of current, and then you have electricity.
What's really exciting about photovoltaics is that they can be created now in sort of thin sheets and put in a lot of places where you couldn't put a mirror and a parabolic trough.
Yeah, they're making them thin and flexible. And yeah, with the parabolic troughs, you have these huge plants like one I visited in outside of Las Vegas, Nevada, where you have hundreds of acres that are lined with these parabolic troughs, which are basically mirrors, and the mirrors focus sunlight onto these tubes of circulating oil, and the oil is heated high enough to make steam and run a turbine. So it's really a huge solar factory. So sometimes I call that big solar.
And that's, in fact, what most utilities use. They're on those systems right now.
Yeah, and there's advantages and disadvantages. You know, all these things are trade-offs. But like with big solar and parabolic troughs, it's also called solar thermal because you're capturing the sun's heat to make steam. Yeah, those are really good. I mean, first, obviously, you have to be someplace like the Southwest where you get very few cloudy days, and that where you get a lot of insulation. That's I-N-S-O-L, insulation coming down from the sun, a lot of sunshine. And then it's good if they're near big population centers, but that's the problem. Like, there's this huge Nevada Solar One plant that's right next to Las Vegas, which is one of the great energy guzzlers of the planet. So that makes sense, but unfortunately, a lot of the demand for electricity is going to be, you know, many, many hundreds of miles away from the best place to generate solar, and then you're going to have to start talking about running more power lines and things. So in some cases, that argues for having more localized solar in like the photovoltaic panels that you can put directly on buildings. But again, that's only going to work where it's sunny.
Yeah, and one of the problems is that, of course, even in places where it is sunny, night falls and there are cloudy days. There have been some advancements, though, in sort of capturing and storing some of this excess energy. Can you talk about
how
that can be done?
That's really the key thing that, you know, after visiting all these places and talking to all these engineers, what really impressed me was that storage is the thing that's really got to be perfected for solar to become mainstream instead of being, you know, just kind of this fringy source of energy that supplies, you know, like a tiny fraction of a percent of our energy needs. You have to be able to store somehow the solar energy, either the heat that's produced from the sun or the electricity that's produced somehow. And so you can use it on cloudy days, you can use it at night.
And there are a lot of interesting ways of doing this, one of which involves compressed air.
Yeah. I mean, the most basic way you can imagine is, let's say you generate excess solar energy during the day, and then you use that to pump water uphill into a reservoir, and then when you need the energy at night, you let the water run down under the power of gravity and run a turbine. And compressed air is the same kind of idea. You use big air pumps during the day to pump underground caverns full of some kind of gas or air, and then under very high pressure, and then at night, you know, you let the pressure come out, and again, you can drive a turbine and make electricity. And, you know, even more basic, you could use giant batteries to store electricity, but so far battery technology is really far from being able to do that efficiently and inexpensively enough.
You have a really interesting graphic in the book that sort of explains one idea for storing energy and separating it, and the only byproduct ultimately is water.
Oh, right, with hydrolysis is another thing. Yeah, because, you know, water's H2O. You know, it's made of molecules of hydrogen and oxygen, and you can use energy to split the hydrogen from the oxygen and, you know, and then keep them apart. And then when you want to use the energy, you allow them to come back together. And, you know, so that's, there's a scientist at MIT, Joseph Nocera, who's been working on that. So it was just really striking how much is going on right now. And for someone like me who was paying attention to this stuff back in the 1970s and early 80s in the Jimmy Carter era when solar energy was, you know, first this exciting thing, and then it kind of went nowhere for various reasons, both technological and political. So it's kind of exciting to see it coming back again.
Yeah, people in the 70s, Jimmy Carter famously put the solar panels onto the roof of the White House.
Right.
And Ronald Reagan came along and took them right down again.
Yeah, perfect paradigmatic story.
Yeah, essentially at that point, the sense was that it was just not efficient enough to ever really make a difference.
Yes, that's right. It was the technology just really wasn't there because, you know, when they started developing semiconductors, you know, in that same era, they really, you know, there were computer semiconductors, and then the same kind of technology could go into solar photovoltaic. And what really the way history, the history of technology went is all the talent went into making all the talent went into making computer chips instead of to making photovoltaic cells. So, you know, we got what they call Moore's Law in the computer industry, where every 2 years, the number of components you could squeeze onto a computer chip approximately doubled, so computing power rose exponentially. We have these amazing laptops now that are more powerful than the, you know, the ultimate supercomputers of 10 years ago. And, you know, people are saying, some people are speculating that, gee, if that kind of talent had gone into solar energy, maybe we'd have something like a Moore's Law for solar cells, and these things have become so efficient now that they would really become a dominant form of energy. But it didn't happen in the 70s, and part of the reasons were political too. There's you have to have the government has to be behind something like this to jumpstart the technology and kind of put the money into it so that the technologies can be developed and then later taken over by private industry. And that's, in fact, what happened with the computer. It was originally pretty much a creation of the Defense Department.
Journalist George Johnson is my guest. We're talking about his article, Plugging into the Sun, which appears in this month's issue of National Geographic magazine. Yeah, let's talk about the money that's required to get these systems underway. It's expensive to start any new energy technology from the ground up. How does a solar system compare with, say, bringing online an oil processing refinery?
Yeah, or coal is the comparison that's often made, because the thing about coal is it's dirt cheap, but it's also
and dirty,
extremely dirty. Yeah. So, and as long as you have, you know, a relatively cheap source of making electricity like coal or oil, you know, it's very hard to go against the grain, and to make solar, as you know, efficient enough, you know, takes a lot of research, and you know, the research costs money, and it's long term research, and that's the sort of thing that it's historically been hard to get corporations to do, and it's usually required some kind of government jump start. I mean, we wouldn't have nuclear energy if it hadn't been for the government developing nuclear fission during World War II, and then the industry kind of spun off that.
There are governments, though, who are making a huge effort in this, and I was fascinated to read that the world leader in solar technology and in the production of solar energy is not a country known for its balmy, sunny weather, Germany.
Yeah, I was amazed, and I went over there. It was in December, and I land in Frankfurt, and there's fog all over the place, and the city's completely socked in clouds, and drive out to this little town called Moorbach out in the country, little farming town, and they have this this big solar energy installation, and I'm standing there, there's snow coming down, and it's completely dark and gloomy, and yet Germany produces the largest percentage per capita of solar energy in the world, specifically because the government got behind it with subsidies.
Yeah. Are the Germans able to, are they making any more strides than we are in terms of storing this power, or do they still have to supplement everything overnight and on these snowy days?
Yeah, it's really, it's still, even though Germany's ahead, we're still talking like about, a tiny, tiny portion of their total energy needs are produced by solar. But it's striking when you drive around there, you just see solar panels everywhere. And the main reason for that is that Germany used a system called a feed-in tariff, where basically what happens is a homeowner or a business owner can install a photovoltaic solar system, on their roof, and then that system is hooked to the grid, and the utilities are required by the German government to buy this electricity from the individual producer for what amounts to about over 50 cents a kilowatt hour, which is several times what we pay for electricity here in the United States. And then the way the system's supposed to work is the German utilities then spread the cost among all of their customers, and supposedly it only adds like maybe a penny or two to the price of a kilowatt hour. And that way they're getting people to produce solar energy and actually making some money doing it. I talked to this one guy who was living in a little townhouse in this complex in Freiburg, Germany, in southern Germany, and he was actually making a net profit every year. He was generating more electricity than he actually used, and using this to help pay off the installation.
Is it your sense that if they weren't receiving more than market rates, even people in Germany wouldn't be that interested in doing solar power?
Yeah, probably not. I mean, I have solar. I live in Santa Fe, New Mexico, so I could easily put in photovoltaic panels in my roof and all this. But, it's really expensive. And there are incentives here as well. They're not as good as the incentives in Germany, but it's becoming, more and more cost-effective to do it. In a few years, it might become cost-effective enough that I would be tipped in the direction of doing it. But I think you do have to provide that economic incentive. And, by providing this incentive, Germany suddenly created this huge demand for photovoltaic panels. So this, ramps up production, and then you get the, the factories become better and better at producing the panels at a cheaper and cheaper price. Good economies of scale, and the price goes down, and more people buy them. So ideally, you get this big positive feedback loop, and that's what, there's some signs that might happen in the rest of the world, in the United States particularly.
Journalist George Johnson is my guest. We're talking about his new article in the September issue of National Geographic magazine called Plugging into the Sun. You can join our conversation now by sending an email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist George Johnson. His article, Plugging into the Sun, appears in the September 2009 issue of National Geographic magazine. If you want to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. George, I was really interested to read this fact. Maybe you call it a factoid that you have in the piece, which is that to power the entire United States with all the electricity we need would take only an area, essentially a square, the area of which is 100 miles on each side.
Yeah, it's really hard to imagine, but this engineer at the National Energy Research Lab in Golden, Colorado, a man named Roland Holmstrom, estimated that, I think back in the 80s, that 100 by 100 mile square covered with solar panels, even the very inefficient solar panels that were prevalent when he made the prediction, like something that was 10% efficient, would be enough to provide all of the U.S. energy needs. And as he tells the story, he was immediately got lots of opposition from environmentalists who thought he really was proposing that they take some huge chunk of the Mojave Desert, like maybe, you know, between Los Angeles and Las Vegas, Nevada, and cover it with one big solar farm. But what he really meant was breaking up this 100 by 100 mile square and then just putting it in, you know, nooks and crannies all over the country in the form of these photovoltaic panels.
And now we're approaching 40% on some solar capture technology.
Yeah, there's been a few. I mean, these are, you know, things that aren't really ready for prime time, but in the laboratory they've gotten, you know, a little over 40% with these very exotic semiconductors. They basically layer three different kinds of photovoltaic cells, you know, made of three different kinds of elements, and they're done in such a way that one layer is really good at absorbing, say, the red end of the spectrum, and one layer is good at doing blue, so they are able to get more of the energy out of the light that way.
We have an email here from Bill in Dallas who asks, how necessary are any of the rare earth elements in the processes that ultimately deliver solar electricity?
Oh, well, of course, the main thing that the, you know, silicon is the main ingredient for making solar panels, which is just, you know, sand, essentially.
We've got plenty of that.
Really high-grade silicon, and you have to have, you know, very specialized factories in order to make it. But some of these exotic semiconductors that I'm talking about use elements like indium and tellurium and things like this. And, you know, those are the ones where they're getting, like, the higher percentages, but they haven't figured out a way to mass-produce that yet.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the line to Jacob in Dallas. Hey, Jacob.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So a couple of years ago, there was a lot of excitement and a lot of talk about hydrogen fuel cells.
Right.
And I heard a conversation, and I want to say it was on a radio talk show. Someone pointed out, and I don't know who, they pointed out that the problem with fuel cells is the shortage of good, cleanly produced hydrogen, mm-hmm. and that the problem with solar and wind is the storage issue that
right.
you alluded to. And suggested closing the loop and that you use wind and solar to generate hydrogen and then use your hydrogen whenever you need to run fuel cells.
Yeah.
I got very excited by that, and it seemed just so perfect. And yet, I might have missed something, but it feels like in the 2 years since then, I've never heard in any sort of forum, I've never heard that suggested. So is that a real idea? And if not, why isn't everyone talking about it?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I'm trying to think. Back during my research for the article, you know, I ran across, you know, mentions here and there, but it didn't seem to be a major thrust, and I don't know why. You know, a really good place to look for the answer to that would be the National Renewable Energy Laboratory's website. It's nrel.gov, and they have an amazing archive of information that's pretty well arranged by topic on solar, wind, hydrogen, and probably, you know, you could get a sense from, you know, kind of wading through the archives just how seriously this was being taken and if there was some fundamental reason why not.
Do you have the sense that it needs to be national laboratories that are taking the lead on this, or will it probably be private corporations that ultimately get us from where we are now to where we would like to be?
Well, it's both, I think. And NREL, the government lab, one of the things they do, I mean, it's almost the main thing they do is partnerships with private industry. So if somebody has, like, a new idea for a new kind of semiconducting photovoltaic panel, they might put together a prototype, and then NREL will help them test it for efficiency and things like that. So they both fund basic research, do basic research, and do some partnerships with private industry. But it really takes both. But, the main thing is getting over this hump where you can get the technology up to the point where the efficiencies are high enough that it makes sense for people to buy into the technology and to get it cheap enough, you know, so that it can be mass-produced. So you mass-produce it so the costs go down, and it's just, you know, kind of a classic chicken-and-egg problem. To get the cost to go down, you have to mass-produce this stuff, but to mass-produce it, you have to have this big demand, and the demand's not going to be there until the price goes down. So I remember one scientist that I talked to who had started out in the computer industry, and then he got into solar, and he was saying, like, you know, people from Silicon Valley who work for, like, Intel and all the big computer chip makers, that they'll go into a factory that's making photovoltaic panels, very similar technology, but the conditions are just comparatively very, very primitive because some, you know, little money's been put into it. And, you know, just the answer to how you get beyond that hump is probably, you know, government subsidies and, you know, to corporations that can eventually make a lot of money out of it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go next to Chris in Arlington. Hello, Chris.
Hello. Semiconductor manufacturing processes are always getting obsoleted. Can the old machines be reused to make solar cells?
Well, I don't know, but that seems very possible that, you know, you could retool something like that. And yeah, that's a very interesting suggestion. And, yeah, I don't know, but that sounds very plausible.
What about the maintenance for solar cells, whether they're photovoltaic cells or there are these systems with the parabolic troughs and mirrors and things like that? I spent several years living in El Paso, which would be a great place to capture solar energy, but it's an awfully dusty place.
Well, yeah, you do have to clean them off.
Yeah, yeah.
Regularly. And when I was at Nevada Solar One, with the big parabolic troughs, these rows of curved mirrors, you know, there they have a water truck that just, you know, constantly, you know, is slowly moving, you know, around this whole array of solar collecting mirrors and then spraying off the dirt. So
it's got to be a thankless job.
Yeah, it's kind of nice though. You know, it's quiet out there, and you know, these plants are just so beautiful to look at too, with the rows and rows of mirrors. And
yeah, there's, as always with National Geographic, you have some stunning photographs that accompany the piece.
This photographer Michael Melford just did some amazing photographs.
Did he get those from the air?
Some of them he did, and I wasn't with him when the photographs were taken. In fact, I've never physically met him, just through email and I think on a telephone conference call. But I know there's this one really striking photo he has of a small farm in the Bavaria region of Germany.
Yeah,
that's outfitted with all these photovoltaics. And as I understand it, to do that picture, he had to use a helium balloon. So he arrived in Frankfurt and had to find out where one gets a large tank of helium to put in the back of the rental car, and actually sent up a balloon with a camera with electronic remote control to take the picture.
Wow. I guess they'll do anything for the shot.
Oh, yeah. Some of these photographers are just amazing.
George Johnson is with us. We're talking about his article in the current issue of National Geographic. We'll go back now to the phones and this time speak with Matt in Fort Worth. Hi, Matt.
Hi. I was considering a solar system for my home, and in the course of discussing it with a friend of mine, he said, well, if you can't afford it all at once, maybe you should just buy one panel a year and over time accumulate enough. And it sounded good on paper, but I don't know if that's something that's realistic to do.
Yeah. I think I'd be more tempted to wait a little while because, you know, prices really are coming down. And, you know, people who put this in, you know, 5 years ago are probably, you know, kicking themselves because they could do the same system for much less today. There was an article in the New York Times just a couple of weeks ago, Yeah, on August 27th, the headline was "More Sun for Less: Solar Panels Drop in Price." And partly the reason they're dropping is because of the recession, and unfortunately because of falling demand. And it's also, though, because of competition. More and more companies are getting into making solar panels. So I think you're going to see the prices go down quite a lot and the efficiency go up in the next few years. So, you know, can't really predict, but, you know, I'd be tempted just to kind of wait and, you know, save the money. And also to look into the subsidies because, you know, there's good federal tax incentives for installing solar, and some states are starting to have incentives. I'm not sure about Texas, but I know in New Mexico, if you put up solar panels, you can actually spin your meter backwards and produce an excess of electricity and get paid for it by the utility company.
It's nice to get money from them once in a while.
Yeah.
How durable are photovoltaics once people put them up? Is this something that you could expect to last for a matter of decades?
Oh, yeah, I think so. And I don't think the maintenance is really that hard. And I didn't, in researching this, I didn't get a whole lot into the practical concerns. I remember in Germany, several people told me they were having problems with what's called the inverter box, which is this box of electronics that takes the output from your photovoltaic cells, which is, you know, kind of low voltage direct current, and then it has to increase the voltage and make it into alternating current so that it, you know, works in the grid. And apparently they had a lot of problems with those not lasting so long. But, you know, all this stuff presumably comes with a warranty.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We'll go next to Patrick in Coppell. Hey, Patrick.
Hey, how's everybody today?
Great, thank you.
Well, what a great conversation. I'm driving in my car, and I have my radio off, and I happen to be in the solar business. A couple of areas real quickly that you touched on. Maintenance for these systems, nobody really knows yet. The collectors, the photovoltaic collectors themselves, they have probably a typical 50-year life expectancy, and, yeah, you just clean them off. The inverters, yeah, they have a warranty, and maybe they have 10 to 15-year lifespan, depending on how hot they get and how you protect them. A question for George. Are you familiar with this new sort of emerging technology for the cells themselves? It's an expanded carbon molecule, somewhere about 25% efficiency right now, and hoping to improve on that. That was one question. Mm-hmm. And one other thing you guys touched on was selling power back to the grid. Encore Energy is sort of our wholesale provider here in Dallas area. They own the meters. And we don't have what you refer to as called net metering, mm-hmm. Where you essentially, quote-unquote, run the meter backwards.
Right. And
if you're generating more power than you're consuming, you sell it back to the system, typically at a wholesale price. Austin, Texas is a great city for that. They're leading the country, practically. I guess you put California in there, too, but because of the way our Congress works, it's our budget. It was in the House Bill 545 that was recently voted down, mm-hmm. but I guess it'll come back up in a couple of years, and we'll be waiting for that. Any comments on that? I know I just threw a lot of info at you.
Patrick, before we get George's response, can you just talk for a minute? You said you're in the business. Are the kinds of people who are calling you changing?
Say again?
Are the sorts of people who are calling you interested in installing solar, either on their home or their business, are you seeing
difference? Like Matt was calling, the previous caller was talking about the economics of it. Right now we have in place a 30% rebate can be taken as a federal grant or as a tax credit, and that's from the federal government. Encore still, and they still have funding for this, will pay you $2.46. It's a one-time rebate in the form of a check, $2.46 per watt installed. And that's how you rate these systems, based on the size of the system. I have one on the table right now, which is an 8 kW system. That's 8,000 watts. So 8,000 times 246 is around 19 grand. It's a great incentive, and I encourage people to look at that. And yes, the cost of manufacturing of the cells themselves, the collectors, has gone down dramatically, but I think it's leveling off now. I mean, we're looking at maybe 50, 60% decrease in the cost of these cells over the last 2 or 3 years. which is significant. So,
well,
but I think it will level off.
Yeah, thanks so much for your call. Did you want to talk for a minute, George, about the expanded carbon molecule technology?
Yeah, I don't know about that one. I may have read about it at some point, but it's among these these more exotic technologies that they're trying to harness to get these higher efficiencies. And it'll be interesting to see which ones really end up coming into the market.
Do you think there's a sort of critical mass we need to get to in terms of efficiency, the point at which people don't think they need to wait a couple more years to see what's going to happen?
Yeah, I know with solar thermal, that with the big plants, the big solar parabolic trough plants, they're saying that in some ways that's reached what they call grid parity, meaning that costs the same to produce the solar energy as it does to produce it by coal and or nuclear. But this is only true among it's only true like late in the afternoon during Los Angeles or Las Vegas's or Los Angeles's peak power consumption time, because there it costs so much extra to produce each one of those extra kilowatts that are needed to power the city when it's drawing this huge demand from air conditioning and things. And at those moments, solar, even though it's normally more expensive per kilowatt hour, is actually gets to be cost effective. It's competitive with coal. So a lot of the plants that are being built and have been built since the 1980s in the Mojave Desert are really used to take advantage of that fact, to provide that extra boost that you need during peak demand times. So to get it down to where, it's going to compete with coal and nuclear the rest of the time, it's going to have to, come down. I don't know, what the number would be, but certainly better than it is now.
George Johnson is my guest. His article, Plugging Into the Sun, is featured in the September issue of National Geographic. You can get on the line to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Journalist George Johnson is my guest. He's got a piece in the current issue of National Geographic magazine called Plugging Into the Sun. It's about where we are today with solar energy production. If you'd like to join us, you can send an email to think@kera.org. The phone number is 1-800-933-5372. And that's where we find Tom in Dallas. Hi, Tom.
Hi there. I wanted to talk to George about concentrated solar voltaic. He mentioned that. That uses the triple junction cells, the high-efficiency cells that he mentioned. George, there's a company out of Australia called Green and Gold Energy that has been designing and has now licensed the systems for that. There's a plant that's been built and is in operation in India, and I think they've got a couple of other plants in progress around the world.
Ah.
And the cool part about these guys, concentrated solar voltaic, or the triple junction cells, is you can use a large lens
right. And
concentrate the sun on these. And these guys are now shipping systems using 1,000 sun concentration.
Right. So they use a large, usually a Fresnel lens, right?
Fresnel lens on top of them. And,
yeah, you're really...
They're sampling cells from the manufacturer that are capable of using 2,000 sun concentrations.
So is this
I saw some of those when I was in Spain, and there was a plant out outside of Sevilla where they were using concentrating photovoltaic cells. I'm not sure if they were the triple junction ones, but they were using the Fresnel lenses to concentrate the intensity of the sun so you get more bang for your buck.
So is this like little kids using a magnifying glass to burn holes in leaves?
Yeah, or to explode ants.
The crueler of among the children.
Yeah, right. So, yeah, it's the same thing. I mean, you can obviously, concentrate. You don't have to just take the sun as it comes down through the atmosphere, but you can concentrate it with lenses onto the photovoltaic cells and increase the efficiency. And they use mirrors, too, the same place in outside of Sevilla, Spain. They would have photovoltaic systems hooked up with mirrors to, like, double the sun. But as the gentleman who just called was suggesting, you can go thousands and thousands of suns, just with these lenses. So,
is there potential damage? There's another interesting image in the article. There, you could create so much power potentially with these reflectors.
Yeah, this is going back again to this plant. It's called Andesol outside of Sevilla, and this is a different technology than most plants. And although the United States tried it, back in the 80s, and it's starting to come back in some proposed projects in California. But instead of having the long rows of parabolic troughs that are, heating oil and pumping it into a steam turbine plant, they have all these mirrors, or heliostats, they call them, that are computer-driven to track the sun during the day, and they all focus onto a single point at the top of this big tower. And they can produce so much energy that they have people sitting in the control room to control the mirrors, because if they were allowed to produce the maximum amount of energy possible, they would basically melt the solar collector in the top of the tower. And apparently the engineer that I talked to there who ran the plant, when I interviewed him, he said that the energy that this produced, the energy flux, the engineers called it, was equivalent to what's produced in the core of a nuclear plant. And he later backed off from that and said he wasn't actually sure that he could justify that with the numbers, but it's getting there. It's extremely hot.
We have an email here from Ken in Garland who says, there's a belief among some people almost amounting to a conspiracy theory that corporate forces are actively working against solar technology. In your research, did you discover any such active opposition from particular business or political
entities?
Well,
no. I mean, I'm sort of preternaturally disposed to dismiss conspiracy theories. In fact, the very first book that I wrote was kind of an analysis of the psychology and politics of conspiracy theories. And a lot of times I think things that look like conspiracies are just sort of natural products of economic forces. I mean, if you're an oil company or a coal company and you're making money on these technologies, you're obviously going to, have a certain, prejudice against forms of energy that might compete with your profits, and it's possible you might fund studies and things that would, show that solar will never be efficient enough and things like that. So I'm sure these things happen, but I think rather than, nefarious conspiracies, it's more just, the usual power corporate politics, which...
Always a factor.
Yeah. But, I mean, there's a difference.
800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Amit in Plano. Hi, Amit.
Yeah, hi, Chris. Very interesting conversation, as always.
Thank you.
I do have a question for your guest. Real estate agents say that if you invest, say, $10,000 in your kitchen, you can expect to get maybe 80% of it back through increased value of your home. As a homeowner, if I was to invest an equivalent amount on solar panels, does your guest know, either through experience or any evidence that exists, can homeowners expect an increased value of their home if they sell it?
I haven't seen anyone claim that, and it's a really interesting question, because, and also a question that raises in my mind that I don't know the answer to is, if you're getting these government incentives, whether they're federal or state incentives in many states, in some places even local incentives, like I was reading that Gainesville, Florida had a feed-in tariff similar to Germany, but then if you sell the house, to what extent do those transfer, to the new owner? So I think it would depend a lot on that, and I just don't know. Maybe it's because, solar, as far as, personal solar systems and individual houses, hasn't been around here long enough for it to become a big issue, but maybe someone out there listening who's involved in the solar business knows the answer to that.
Let's go next on the phones to Robert in Cleburne. Hello, Robert.
Hello. I have a question on the solar panels that you have put on your home and everything. They're definitely going to have to generate some heat. Can you piggyback a water heating system to heat your, so drop out a hot water heater out of your house, use it to heat the system and the water to produce it?
Yeah, I haven't seen anything like that, and it's something I was wondering myself because it seems to me that, you know, personally, if I were going to put in solar right now, I'd be interested in putting in solar hot water heating because, you know, that technology is, you know, pretty basic. You know, there's not going to be these huge strides in making more efficient ways to heat water with sunlight, while photovoltaic, you know, still has a lot of room for improvement. But I haven't seen anyone offering a combined system like that. And because part, you know, the energy that you were taking, if you were taking mostly visible light from the visible spectrum with the photovoltaic cells, and then you were leaving the low infrared energy going through to heat water, it certainly seems like it would be technically possible, but I just don't think I've seen anything like that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Ben in Fort Worth. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Chris. Great show.
Thank you.
Very quickly, I have heard that you can recoup between one-third and half of the price of any solar upgrades that you do to your home on a resale. And that there's potential that maybe that would increase in the future. My question has to do more with protection of these assets. I live here in Texas, so I'm thinking about potential damage that might come by way of a hailstorm or something like that. Or, you know, back to the real estate question, is there maybe a way that you could factor in depreciation of some of these things into resale? So if you, say, put a $5,000 unit on your home and, you know, it's been there for 10 years, clearly that's not going to be the same quality as a brand new system.
Right.
So could your guest maybe address any of that?
Yeah, I don't really know if that would be a, you know, something you could do with taxes or, yeah, I just don't know.
I'm sure there's a CPA somewhere that can, if not on this program, at least answer that question for Ben. But what about the question susceptibility to things like hail? We do worry a lot about that here in Texas.
Yeah, and I don't know. Because, again, as someone who called in earlier suggested, these things haven't, you know, been installed, you know, long enough that we have a really good idea, you know, as far as durability and how fast they deteriorate. But, you know, I would think, you know, just as, you know, you can make, you know, windows and other transparent surfaces to, you know, be somewhat hail resistant, you could do the same thing. But then again, it's up there on your roof, so it's getting maximum exposure. Yeah, another great question. I mean, it's just, this is just also new.
Yeah, you'll have to follow this up with something. We'll look for you again in National Geographic over the next few months.
Yeah.
Let's go next to Brandon in Keller. Hi, Brandon.
Hello. How are you today?
Great. Thank you.
Very good. Mr. Johnson, I have ideas on storage, electric storage, especially with plug-in vehicles coming around. What can you do to, you know, if you have ideas or, you know, someone you can trust to be able to find out if this is viable?
Yeah, you mean someone you could trust to, like, if you're looking for information and maybe developing it into a business?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think probably for something like NREL to get involved, it would probably, you know, have to be developed to the point where you had some kind of prototype or something. So then, you know, before that, you'd presumably, you know, be dealing with venture capitalists and things like that. And you could probably find out quite a lot, though, just from reading papers that are already written, you know, that are in the archives, like at NREL.gov, and that way you wouldn't have to, you know, be calling people up and then suggesting, you know, what may be a, you know, a unique idea that they hadn't had before that you would want to protect. And, of course, you could patent it, but then you have to develop it to a certain extent to do that. I guess probably if you had a specific idea, a patent attorney might be the best place to start.
Does the groundbreaking research in this area take place behind closed doors, and is it then revealed sort of after it's completed and ready for market?
No, I mean, from what I can tell, it's all pretty public, at least, you know, what's going on at NREL, and that's where they developed the 43% efficiency, you know, AccelerCell. You know, and that's all very, you know, it's public government-funded research. And then in Germany, there's kind of an equivalent of NREL in Freiburg that's particularly specializes in solar, and they do the same kind of research, all very open. But, you know, of course, you know, you never know what's going on behind corporate doors, and they don't have the obligation to reveal trade secrets. But
yeah, George, yeah. How well do you think lawmakers understand the potential and the requirements of broad-scale solar energy generation in this country?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's something, you know, it probably, you know, I'm sure most lawmakers in Congress have, you know, someone on their staff that specializes in issues like this, and you know, are familiar with feed-in tariffs and different forms of government subsidies and, you know, and the state-of-the-art of the research and things like this. But, you know, as far as to what extent this is in the forefront of the minds of very many people in Congress, I don't know. It's hard to be optimistic.
Did you come home? I guess you were all over the world for this. Did you come home and really get eager and then sort of have to make that decision for yourself that, no, you wanted to wait a few more years until the technology is better to consider investing in your own home?
Yeah, and I kind of came back more. I wasn't thinking so much, you know, as far as doing it personally, but more about the big picture, which is what I really tried to focus on in the article. Like, you know, can the United States or even the world really expect sometime, you know, within our lifetimes to convert our energy system so that a significant portion is produced by solar power? And I came back feeling, you know, really, really encouraged. And I started researching the article last fall. And then, you know, after, you know, the recession or depression 2.0 or whatever you want to call it first hit, I started feeling really discouraged because you'd read all these articles like in the Times about, you know, suddenly all this venture capital and investment for solar energy was drying up because, you know, people couldn't get financing. But, and then when I was starting to write the article, I was feeling, you know, a little down about it. But then during the research, I took a trip to Hoover Dam, and this really inspired me because I thought, you know, here during the Depression, you know, the country got together and the government got behind this you know, the ultimate alternative energy project, Hoover Dam, hydroelectric energy, and, you know, produced this thing. And, you know, sometimes during bad economic times, this is when you can really get people to come together and, you know, make these hard decisions that will pay off in the long run. So, you know, that's my hopefully not too optimistic take on what might happen.
George Johnson's article for the September issue of National Geographic is called Plugging into the Sun. George, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks. I enjoyed it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.